Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Jane Clayson in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. It's the day after Wall Street's bungee jump, but a strong surge in hiring and a modest rise in hourly earnings is buoying Wall Street today after yesterday's sharp plunge and partial recovery. One analyst said the drop happened so quickly it was like a torpedo. Others are looking into the causes, with a hearing scheduled on Capitol Hill in Washington next week. But market watchers say even if it turns out to be a computer-aided human error, yesterday's plunge in share value reveals the real fear stalking financial markets. Michael Santoli, assistant editor, associate editor of Barron's, joins me now with the latest economic and market news. Michael, welcome.
Thank you very much.
So what do we know today about the free fall and partial recovery yesterday on Wall Street?
Well, we don't know everything, but what seems to have happened, at least by most estimations, is that a very large and possibly errant order to sell stock index futures — this is a derivative based on the value of U.S. stocks — seemed to have kind of driven a lot of automated trading off of the regular exchanges in electronic marketplaces that essentially try to sniff out large orders and then react to those prices. And it created a mini spiral downward and some lots of faulty prices that seemed to have been generated in very large companies like Procter & Gamble. That immediately caused most traders to back away and essentially created a vacuum in the market for several minutes.
But some firms stopped trading at a certain volume. Others stopped trading because they sensed something wasn't quite right. Isn't that true?
That's true, yeah. Their systems are usually built to try and detect obvious mistaken orders, and that seems to have happened. And some of those firms that did back away were some of the very high-frequency computer-driven trading firms, which kind of act as buffers on large volatile moves, believe it or not. They sort of take the other side of public orders very frequently, and therefore that also caused overall activity to essentially evaporate and, again, cause people a lot of consternation and allow prices to kind of fall into that air pocket.
So the electronic trigger points, the trader error possibly. Talk about the effect, though, of the financial crisis in Greece, because even before this sharp drop, markets were down and they've had a bad week, haven't they?
Without a doubt. I mean, it was obviously the market was at a vulnerable point because of all these general concerns. In fact, the Dow legitimately was down 300 to 400 points going into that plunge. So what's going on in Greece is traders are watching for a replay potentially, or they fear a replay of the credit crisis that swept through financial institutions in the private sector going on now with governments. Greece has far too much debt. We've known that for a while. The markets are not permitting Greece to easily borrow more. There is a bailout package on the table by mostly European countries as well as the International Monetary Fund, but political tensions are kind of preventing it from getting cleared, both in Germany and, of course, as you see on the streets of Athens. This is causing nervousness that it could cause a chain reaction of government debt problems, which would raise global interest rates and make the financial system vulnerable again.
As one of your colleagues writes in Barron's today, you know it's a bear market when the Dow Jones ends a day down 358 points and traders breathe a sigh of relief. Bears are looking at things like the price of gold, lending, and bond markets. What do they see, especially with today's job numbers? We're pretty strong.
They very much were strong. The domestic economic numbers here have been relatively good, in fact, better than expected in most respects. What the bears will tell you, though, is this is almost entirely the effect of government stimulus and the Federal Reserve keeping interest rates so low, and that once that help is withdrawn from the system, that we won't have a self-sustaining economic recovery. And that's an argument that's certainly plausible. It remains to be seen if big companies are going to aggressively hire before they know that we have something durable in the way of recovery. I happen to think there's a good chance we do have something self-sustaining, but the bears really are right that the system is fragile, and it's by no means a certainty that we are going to have an ongoing recovery that's going to get us back to reasonable employment levels.
So a bad week for the market comes on the heels of seemingly a long upward trend, relatively speaking. You read something into that, too.
Without a doubt. I mean, we have been in the market has been in healing mode since March of 2009. S&P 500, the main index looked at by professionals, up some 75% since the low in March of 2009. In fact, the market is trading right at the level it was right around the time that Lehman Brothers failed. So what we've done is kind of recovered most of the losses of that panic phase. And obviously, the system has been healed back to health to some degree. But right now, it's a matter of questioning whether the future fundamentals are going to justify even higher prices. I honestly believe the stock market was in search of an excuse to back off a bit. And in fact, Goldman Sachs fraud charges and all the rest of it have served as good excuses to actually take some money off the table.
Last 10 seconds, Michael. Consumer spending, an important economic indicator. Where do you see that going?
It actually should be relatively positive. Everything hinges on the employment numbers, which are obviously now going the way we want to see.
Michael Santoli, Associate Editor of Barron's. Thank you very much, Michael.
My pleasure. Thanks.
The explosion of the USS Maine in Havana Harbor on February 15, 1898, ignited the Spanish-American War. But the drumbeat for battle had started long before that. A powerful group of men led by Theodore Roosevelt, Senator Henry Cabot Lodge, and newspaperman William Randolph Hearst had been agitating for war, any war, for several years. The destruction of the USS Maine gave them the spark they needed to push President William McKinley to action. The subsequent war thrust the United States onto the world stage and set the stage for American foreign policy for years to come. And as we will hear, the Spanish-American War echoes the war in Iraq. Evan Thomas, editor-at-large at Newsweek, tells the story in his fascinating new book, The War Lovers, Roosevelt, Lodge, Hearst, and the Rush to Empire, 1898. And he joins me now in the studio. Evan Thomas, welcome to Here and Now. Nice to have you.
Hi, Jane.
Before we talk about the rush to war in 1898, let's talk about the comparison between the Spanish-American War and the war in Iraq. You say there's an eerie similarity. How so?
Well, I got into this book because I was writing for Newsweek a lot about the war in Iraq. And about 2006, I began thinking about the nature of war fever. Obviously, wars can be necessary and noble. We think of World War II. But as Iraq was a war of choice, so was the Spanish-American War, I decided to go back a century and just look at this phenomenon of war fever. What is it that makes Americans, really any people, want to fight?
You've also talked about looking back at this history from the late 1800s, that doing so has forced you to rethink your support for the war in Iraq. Can you talk us through that?
I was a hawk on the war in Iraq, certainly the invasion of Iraq. And I remember wondering at the feeling in my own newsroom at the time. There were policy reasons for it, WMD and all that, but there was something deeper going on, something more primitive or atavistic, if you will. You know, journalists love conflict, and the greatest conflict is war. And I think that I'm a Vietnam-era generation. I'm 59, and I missed Vietnam. I was too late for it, and I had a high draft number, and I was against it. But there are a lot of my contemporaries in journalism now, and it's a funny thing that so many of us were pretty hawkish. We don't always like to admit this, but pretty hawkish in about February 2003. Again, I think that there was something deeper than just policy going on here. There was this it's hard to put your finger on it, but this kind of love of conflict.
Do you regret that, your support for the war in Iraq?
Yes. I have sort of muddy feelings about the war in Iraq. By 2006, when I got going on this book, I was feeling terrible about it because the war was going to hell. I thought we were losing. The surge did work, sort of. There is some kind of democracy in Iraq. It was not a complete failure by any means. Now, 4,000 Americans or more have died there. That's an awfully big price to pay.
So take us back now and introduce us to these characters from the past, the war lovers in your story. First, who was Teddy Roosevelt in the late 1800s?
You couldn't sort of miss Teddy Roosevelt. He was a force of nature, a young man in the Republican Party who was obviously coming on, incredibly outspoken, bit of a blowhard, but kind of an appealing one at the same time. He and his friend Henry Cabot Lodge, you know, they're ready for a war with Germany or Great Britain, maybe liberate Canada, attack Mexico. I mean, pretty much any war would do. Now, you know, I know that sounds nutty, but America was coming out of its shell and about to become an expansionist power. Lodge was the advocate of something called the large policy. The idea was that we should be like Great Britain and have a great navy and be a great commercial power. And to do that, you needed to have possessions abroad, partly just coaling stations for your navy, but they wanted to get Cuba and Puerto Rico. They wanted to have a canal through Nicaragua. They wanted Hawaii. They wanted to expand and become a dominant world power. And Lodge clearly articulated that, and Roosevelt believed it in all his heart. And so that was one big reason, but not the only reason.
So Teddy Roosevelt, then the Republican senator from Massachusetts, Henry Cabot Lodge, pulling the legislative strings for war, documenting it all through this, pushing it even further, really, as you say in your book, was the journalist William Randolph Hearst, bankrolled by his mother.
His mom was paying for it all.
He believed in something called the journalism that acts. Give us a sense of who Hearst was and how he used his newspaper, the New York Journal, to push for a war.
Well, we're all familiar now with sensationalist newspapers and screaming headlines and all that. Hearst helped invent it, he and Joseph Pulitzer. And he discovered a formula out in San Francisco, which was known as crime and underwear. What sells newspaper? Crime and underwear. Crime and underwear was great, but war was better. And Hearst did his best to start a war. I mean, he wasn't shy about it. When this war started, he called it the Journal's War. And he, on his front page, constantly was agitating to liberate Cuba, rescue Cuba. Now, again, it's a little bit like Iraq. There was a genuine humanitarian reason here to go into Cuba. The Spanish were oppressing him. The Cubans were trying to get free, you know, not unlike what Saddam was doing to Iraq. But Hearst embraced it with all his heart. When the Maine blew up, Hearst led the charge saying, ah, Spanish plot. It was a torpedo, a mine, a dastardly Spanish plot. Well, it wasn't. It was an accident. But Roosevelt, who was the Assistant Secretary of the Navy, swept all that evidence under the rug that it was an accident. But it was a sufficient spark to get this war going.
Talk more about the feeling of this time, at least in men like Roosevelt and Lodge, that the United States had become over-civilized, that men were not men anymore, that the country was weak. Where did that come from?
Darwin had discovered evolution by the mid-19th century, and that was transformed into something called social Darwinism. Now, this is going to all sound crackpot today, but the center of the scholarship was Harvard and Yale. They held that there was a master race. The Anglo-Saxon race was a master race. Now, all of this sounds odious today, but that's what they believed, and they believed that they had a duty and a destiny to rule. But they couldn't reconcile with the fact that so many of these guys were getting headaches and stomach aches and felt weakness and lassitude. And there was just a conflict between the greatness that they were supposed to embody and the kind of weariness and neuroticism they felt. It was called neurasthenia. Young men of this time would go west to strengthen themselves. Teddy Roosevelt went west to become a cowboy. And indeed, the myth of the West, the cowboy and Indian thing, was partly a creation of Teddy Roosevelt and Owen Wister, another Harvard guy. Another neurotic Harvard guy who went out west to, and they created this myth of the lonely, solitary, but brave cowboy. Wister wrote a book called The Virginian that Hollywood later discovered. So they filled themselves with this idea that Roosevelt used to call, we need to feel again the wolf rising in the heart. We need to capture this kind of primitive savagery that made us a great race, a conquering race, a dominant race, a race that wiped out the Indians. War to them was a way of reviving the national spirit, of regenerating the upper classes, of discovering the wolf rising in the heart.
That's Evan Thomas of Newsweek. His new book is The War Lovers, Roosevelt, Lodge, Hearst, and the Rush to Empire, 1898. When we come back, Teddy Roosevelt gets his wish. He leads the Rough Riders into battle against the Spanish in Cuba. And later in the program, most people agree that health care costs in this country need to be controlled. But how do you do it? An economist says the solution is a simple one, but doing it is another matter. Back in 1 minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. I'm Jane Clayson in for Robin Young. We continue our conversation now with Evan Thomas, editor at Newsweek. His new book is The War Lovers, Roosevelt, Lodge, Hearst, and the Rush to Empire, 1898. It's the story of Teddy Roosevelt, newspaper mogul William Randolph Hearst, and Senator Henry Cabot Lodge, and how they pushed for the Spanish-American War. There were voices against that war, Congressman Thomas Brackett Reed of Maine, the Harvard philosopher William James, among others. But they couldn't stop it, especially after the USS Maine exploded in Havana Harbor. So, Evan Thomas, tell us about Teddy Roosevelt's role in the fighting in Cuba. He'd been a big game hunter, but he'd never been in battle before, had he? What happened?
Well, Roosevelt, yes, he'd been a big game hunter, but the most dangerous game is man, as Roosevelt himself wrote. And he wanted combat. And so he had left. He was 39 years old when that war broke out.
With a sick wife. Kids who were
oldest kid was having a nervous breakdown. Can you imagine being Teddy Roosevelt Jr.? Roosevelt later wrote that he would have left his wife's deathbed to go to war. He just had to do it. So he enlisted in the Rough Riders, helped organize the Rough Riders. He ordered himself a uniform from Brooks Brothers, and off they went. And in this first battle, when they were ambushed at Las Guasimas, Roosevelt initially tripped over a sword. But that's a cheap shot, because he was brave. He stood up under fire, and he bumbled a little bit at the very first, but then he was a brave man.
Brave, but not shy. I mean, he made sure Hearst reporters were there to document his own exploits on the battlefield. Correct.
Yes, great men who with PR sense know to keep reporters nearby. And Roosevelt made sure to have the most famous correspondent of his day, Richard Harding Davis, right by his side. And Davis, sure enough, Davis wrote the most famous account of Teddy Roosevelt riding up San Juan Hill on his horse with his blue bandana streaming out behind him. And Davis wrote something to the effect that no one who saw him ride up the hill thought he would make it alive. All this was true. He wasn't making it up. It was an incredibly brave thing that Roosevelt did going up that hill. I've been to San Juan Hill. It's actually called Kettle Hill, but I've been there in Cuba. And it's, you know, it's not that tall a hill, but if people are shooting down at you, it looks pretty tall.
So can you really call this a war, Evan Thomas? I mean, weren't more Americans killed by disease during that time, yellow fever, than in battle?
Yes, although that's not so unusual, actually, to have to lose more to disease in battle in the days before penicillin. But 250 soldiers or so died in combat. Now, there's, I think, 750 died from disease. But that was a Cuban piece. We had sent a fleet to the Philippines, to Manila, to defeat a Spanish fleet there, Admiral Dewey. The next thing we knew, we were occupying the Philippines. We hadn't even expected this. We were liberating the Philippines from the Spanish, but that's not the way the Filipinos felt. They started fighting against us. A counterinsurgency started up. Counterinsurgencies, as we know from Iraq, very messy things. There were atrocities on both sides. And for the first time ever, Americans used a torture called waterboarding. It was known as a water cure then. We got it from the Spanish, but we did it. In that conflict, 4,000 Americans died. That's the same number that we've lost in Iraq.
Remind us what happened to Cuba.
Cuba was liberated, but the Americans had the right to intervene anytime they want, and we did intervene a few times in the early 19th century. And the problem was that the Cubans, although they'd been freed, felt that we'd robbed them of their dignity. We excluded the Cuban rebels from the surrender ceremony because they were a ragtag bunch, and because half of them were black. This is a period of growing racism in the United States, and our soldiers were kind of shocked to find out that we were liberating a half-black army that had black officers. The Cubans had a kind of postmodern ideology of there are no blacks, no whites, just Cubans. But the Americans, who were going through their worst period of racism, couldn't understand this. So it was messy, and the Cubans felt we robbed them of their dignity, and they never quite got over that. They feel that war was yesterday. There were big posters outside Santiago talking about Cuban dignity and how the Americans robbed them of it.
What happens to the U.S. after this war? I mean, how did the United States emerge from the Spanish-American War?
In some ways, we emerged as a great power, and we got Puerto Rico and Guam, and we annexed Hawaii. But it's too simple to say we became this great imperial power, because Americans were not very eager imperialists. By the election of 1900, the anti-imperialists didn't do well, but it's not like there was a great cry in America, gee, let's go out and conquer a bunch of colonies the way Britain or Germany was doing it. And it really wasn't until World War I came that we broke out of it quite fiercely to go march off to France. But then it returned again. By the 1930s, America was isolationist again, and it took World War II. But even after World War II, I wrote a book called The Wise Men with Walter Isaacson, and I remember Averill Harriman, one of our characters, a great diplomat, said, after World War II, Americans just wanted to come home, go to the movies, and drink Coke. We couldn't because of communism and all that, and we had to rescue Europe and the Marshall Plan, but it's not really America's desire to conquer the world, although for a country that doesn't desire it, we've done a lot of it.
You talk about in the book a real sadness for Roosevelt.
Yeah.
One of his other sons,
youngest son, actually, Quentin.
In action.
Yes.
In World War I. You describe a scene, an aging Roosevelt sitting in the trophy room of his home, staring past the pages of his book, murmuring his dead son's name. Yeah. The romance was gone, clearly, of war.
I mean, here's this guy, lived so much for war, and he wanted his four sons to fight. When the oldest one, Archie, was wounded, Roosevelt and his wife threw their wine glasses into the fireplace at their home in Sagamore Hill. They were so proud of him and so happy. And yet the youngest son is shot down over France in a dogfight. He's a pilot. And the Roosevelts recover the axle to the plane, this bent black axle, and they hang it over the fireplace. It's still there. That's how you can see it. It's still at Sagamore Hill in Oyster Bay in Long Island. And Roosevelt, as you say, this time finally the heartbreak caught up. And he would pretend to read a book and mutter his youngest son's name, Quinty, Quinty. And within 6 months, he was dead.
So finally, Evan Thomas, can we take any lessons from this story today?
I think it's a lesson that we really never do learn, because there is such as this kind of primitive need to fight, particularly young men who feel this need to test themselves. And then a lot of old men, and particularly, I'm sorry to say, old men who have not fought themselves, who have this need to send young men off to fight. That piece of it, I wish we were a little bit more reflective about, but I'm not naive about this.
Evan Thomas, editor-at-large at Newsweek. His new book is The War Lovers, Roosevelt, Lodge, Hearst, and the Rush to Empire, 1898. Evan, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks, Jane.
News is next, here and now.
Support for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, Charles River Apparel, over a quarter century of creating apparel for corporations and athletic teams based in New England and family-owned, on Facebook at facebook.com/Charles River Apparel, and the Institute of Contemporary Art on the Boston waterfront. Discover the power and beauty of new art and ideas, icaboston.org.
British Prime Minister Gordon Brown says he is prepared to speak to any other party about forming an alliance a day after his party lost significant ground in an election that for the first time in four decades had no clear winner. Or, as Britain's former Liberal Democrat leader Patty Ashdown commented, the country has spoken, we just don't know what they've said. So today the political wrangling begins as the parties struggle to form a coalition to govern the country. The BBC's Marianne Segar joins us from Westminster. Marianne, nice to have you.
Thanks very much.
There was no outright winner, as you know, but Conservatives made the largest gains. Can you explain what led to the push to the right?
Well, Gordon Brown has been one of the most unpopular prime ministers ever, and he's also presided over, as in many countries, the most terrible recession. And so Labour, under him, have been getting less and less popular with the voters. David Cameron, meanwhile, who's the leader of the opposition Conservative Party, which is a bit like the Republican Party, though rather more centrist, he has been making his party more moderate, I would say, in effect doing the opposite of the Republicans in the US, more liberal, more modern, really, and therefore is making his party more attractive to voters. So you've got an influence in both directions, that Labour were becoming less popular because of the recession and this leader who nobody had ever voted for because he took over from Tony Blair in between elections, and the Conservatives have been becoming more popular, but not popular enough, actually, to win a majority.
Well, they're expected to gain more than 90 seats, and as you say, Gordon Brown's Labour Party is slated to lose that many. Is Gordon Brown making any moves to step down today?
He's not yet, no. And of course, under the British Constitution, the Prime Minister remains Prime Minister until he loses the support of the House of Commons. That means, you know, if Gordon Brown decided to carry on and hold a vote in the House of Commons and lost it, then the Queen, who's our head of state, would call for the other party leader to form a government. Now, what he's saying is, I'll carry on as Prime Minister until these negotiations are sorted out. And then if the Liberal Democrats, who are the third party, do a deal with the Conservatives, then they can govern. And if not, then maybe we, Labour, can do a deal with the Liberal Democrats and we'll stay on in government.
During the election, Liberal Democrat Nick Clegg said that Gordon Brown should not continue to, quote-unquote, squat at 10 Downing Street if he lost the election. Does Gordon Brown's Labour Party have any hope of forming a coalition?
To be honest, I don't think he has much hope, because I think it would be fantastically unpopular with the electorate. I mean, voters will say, well, what do we have to do to get rid of a government? You know, we tried to vote Labour out and they're still there, like the Rasputin, you know, the man who couldn't be killed. On the other hand, Labour will be offering the Liberal Democrats much more of what they want than the Conservatives will, because the Liberal Democrats want us to change our voting system so that they get a number of seats in our parliament which is proportionate to the vote that they get. They want it to, the system to be such that if they got 30% of the vote, they'd get 30% of the seats. At the moment, they get much fewer than that. Now, Labour's prepared to offer them at least a halfway house to that. The Conservatives aren't.
So there are rustlings that the Liberal Democrats, led by Nick Clegg, and the Conservatives, with David Cameron, may come to an agreement. So what's the likelihood of an agreement between the most conservative and the most liberal parties?
Well, funnily enough, if you look at them personally, David Cameron himself and Nick Clegg himself aren't that far apart in policy. David Cameron's right to the left of his party and Nick Clegg's to the right of his. So there's not an enormous gulf there to be bridged. And I think it's likely because Nick Clegg said during the course of the campaign that he thought it was right for the party that won the most votes and the most seats to be able to govern in a hung parliament, you know, that they had a moral right to govern. And therefore, that's why he's going to talk to the Conservatives first, even if his policies aren't quite as close to the Conservatives as they are to Labour's.
What about the British pound and the uncertainty that apparently drove it to its lowest level against the dollar in over a year? What is the sense of what this uncertainty could mean for the country and for global markets, for that matter?
Well, that's a real worry for politicians here, and that's why all three party leaders have said, let's get this sorted quickly, because they know that this is a period of great financial instability and uncertainty. And the last thing we want is for the bond markets to precipitate a great political crisis.
That's the BBC's Marianne Seagart. Marianne, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Up next, a prescription for containing health care costs here in the United States. It's Here and Now. Welcome back to Here and Now. I'm Jane Clayson in for Robin Young. It used to be that doctors determined which tests and treatments they prescribed based solely on the accepted standard of care. That is no longer the case. Among the issues doctors now consider are whether their patients are demanding certain tests and drugs. And then there's the fear of being sued, which may push a physician to order tests that have only a remote chance of improving health, simply to prove that they've covered all the bases. The result is a system of chronic overuse, costing billions of dollars in unnecessary spending. By some estimates, up to 30% of all healthcare spending in the United States falls into that category. Jonathan Gruber is a health economist at MIT. I asked him to explain if this unnecessary spending is addressed in the recent reforms out of Washington.
The best evidence we have comes from studies done at Dartmouth University, which show that if you compare, say, people in Miami to people in Minnesota, the people in Miami use about a third more health care than the people in Minnesota, but are in no better health. So that's the kind of evidence that people like President Obama or his budget director, Peter Orszag, point to when they say we can have much more efficient health care. There's the overutilization. But no one's actually figured out how to tell those people in Miami, by the way, you should get a third less care, and which third to take away from them. And that's where it gets tricky, is that it's easy in theory to say we have this extra care. It's very hard in practice to deal with it. In a situation like that, what you want to do is try a bunch of different things and see what works. And this bill takes what I've called the spaghetti approach to health care cost control. It throws a bunch of stuff against the wall and sees what sticks. For example, there's a new tax on high-cost health insurance plans. There's a board to try to depoliticize the process of Medicare rate setting by Congress. There's cost-effectiveness research to help individuals understand what works and what doesn't in their health care. And there are dozens and dozens of new pilots of different ways to try to organize health care, all trying to figure out how we cut out this one-third without sacrificing patient health.
And how long will it take to figure out which of those pieces of spaghetti is actually going to stick and work?
It's going to take, you know, at least a decade because none of them really start till 2014. None of them really start till, 4 years from now. And we need some time to see if they work and evaluate them. So I think we're probably a decade away from really understanding what works to control healthcare costs, at least a decade away. Now, it sounds like a long time, but on the other hand, our experience with health insurance coverage encourages me in the sense that I feel like in the mid-1990s, we knew we had a problem with the uninsured. But we hadn't really figured out how to tackle it constructively. And we were, as I like to think of it, at the bottom of a learning curve. both a political and policy learning curve that we climbed over the past decade, most notably with our success here in Massachusetts, culminating in the law that was passed. I'd like to think that for cost control we'll follow a similar trend where we're sort of at the bottom now. We're struggling to see what works, but hopefully over the next decade we'll climb that learning curve. So a decade from now, we can take those next steps we need to.
What about doctors? Are they supportive, generally speaking, about changing to a model of less utilization, which, frankly, will mean smaller compensation, smaller paychecks?
There's a famous health economist, Uwe Reinhardt, who always holds up a slide. That's his equation to explain healthcare reform, which is healthcare costs equal healthcare income. And basically, that's the problem. We cannot control healthcare costs in America. We simply cannot without two things happening. One is patients getting less of care they now demand, and two is providers earning less money than they now earn. And basically, both those things have to happen, and those are both enormously difficult political lifts. With respect to the patient side, you can see the problem exactly in the huge hubbub over the mammogram issue in December,
right,
when the Preventive Services Task Force came forward and said it's no longer cost-effective to mandate mammograms for women in their 40s. This is a carefully done study by scientific experts, and yet it was immediately caused a huge uproar and literally was explicitly outruled in the legislation. That's why it's hard to tell patients they can't have what they want, and it's obvious why it's hard to tell providers they can't earn as much as they earn.
Which is a perfect example of why so many Americans view this as rationing. I mean, will Americans be willing to accept what they view as rationing of health care?
I think when you say the word rationing, it raises images of, for example, what Britain used to do, which is they'd say if you're above a certain age, you can no longer have a transplant. We're never going to do that in America, never. We're never going to have that kind of explicit rationing. What we need to do is move towards sort of more rational rationing system, which is a system of explicit two-tier medicine. I mean, right now in America, we have a system where the vast majority of Americans are overtreated and a substantial minority are incredibly undertreated. We need to move to a system where everyone is more properly treated. But if a rich person wants to buy more, we let them. That's the American way. If I want to have a bigger TV, I can have a bigger TV. If I want to have better health care, I can have better health care. Some people view that as fundamentally unfair, but I think that that's just a pipe dream to think that the rich won't get more. I think we need to ensure that everyone gets a minimal level, and if the rich want to buy up, let them.
Is there a system in place now anywhere in the world where that actually works?
I mean, it's very much like a lot of the European systems, where basically they have a basic level that may be too low for America. Maybe the waits are too long and other things. But it's very much like the European systems with a basic level of publicly provided insurance, and then people can opt out and buy out of the public system to private care for things they want, like hip replacements and other things.
But aren't taxes much, much higher in places like that?
Well, taxes are much higher for lots of reasons, but partly taxes are higher because they pay for the system out of taxes rather than out of wages. They spend less on health insurance. It's just the way we pay for it is hidden in workers having lower wages. They pay for it explicitly in paying higher taxes instead. But overall, the higher taxes they pay are much lower than the lower wages we receive.
Physicians say that patients are demanding the care and the often unnecessary tests. But isn't there a standard of care that prevents that from happening? I mean, are physicians forced to bow to the pressure of their patients?
No, not really. I mean, I think, you know, I think it's wrong to blame any one party here. I mean, I think insurers, providers and patients all bear blame in roughly equal proportions. The providers bear blame because, look, the typical doctor is not in it just to make money. Okay, the image of the doctor doing this extra care just to make money is wrong. At the same time, people like money, and if I know that I can, there's some chance that a test I can do as a doctor might benefit you, and I'll make a little money from it on the side, then why not? So that's one piece of the puzzle. The second piece of the puzzle is the patient has no financial skin in the game. So I have a health plan where I pay $10 or $25 if I go get an MRI or an X-ray. What do I care? That's trivial relative to my income. I have no incentive to tell the doctor not to give it to me. And then finally, insurers, who could be the middleman that helps solve this problem, really don't do a very good job of trying to. They just say, well, we'll just let providers charge what they want and pass it on to employers in the form of higher premiums. Insurers aren't getting in the middle and trying to create a more rational system.
How do you see this issue of overutilization playing out in the long term?
I think that in the long term, the Nobel Prize-winning economist Herb Stein once said, if something has to end, it will. We eventually have to get healthcare costs under control. We will get healthcare costs under control. And the long term, it's going to be about all three of these parties, insurers, providers, and patients, chipping in to move towards a more rationalized system.
Jonathan Gruber, thank you very much.
You bet.
Jonathan Gruber is a health economist at MIT. Just ahead, the TV series Lost is almost over. We'll discuss what on earth has been happening and how it might end. Back in a bit, Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world, uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Welcome back. I'm Jane Clayson in for Robin Young. Fans of the hit show Lost know that sound well. It signals that the story is about to shift sideways in time into a parallel reality, showing us what might have been or what could be if the plane never crashed on the island. What plane, you ask? Well, that would be Oceanic Flight 815. For viewers, it crashed on a remote South Pacific island 6 years ago. But for the show's characters, time is relative.
I can't shoot you, because if you die in 1977, then you'll never come back to the island on the freighter 30 years from now.
I can die, because I've already come to the island on the freighter. Any of us can die, because this is our present.
But you said Ben couldn't die because he still has to grow up and become the leader of the others.
Because this is his past.
Lost? Who isn't? The island is one crazy place. It's got polar bears, giant ancient statues, and a pair of supernatural guys, Jacob and the Man in Black, who, by the way, can turn into a black, smoky killing machine. The series will wrap up on May 23rd, and everyone seems to have a theory about how it will end. Nancy Miller is an editor at Wired magazine, which published a big feature on Lost in its May issue. Nancy, welcome.
Thank you.
First of all, there are only 3 episodes left, and many people still have no idea what is going on. Do you think creator J.J. Abrams and his team will be able to wrap all this up?
I'm with you. I'm thinking 3 episodes. How are they going to do this? Especially because we know the upcoming episode is going to be the origin story of Jacob, the angel, and the Man in Black, who is the force of evil. So really, you only have 2 episodes after that to wrap things up. And, you know, this show is about science versus faith. And I'm usually a woman of science, but in this instance, I am a woman of faith to believe that J.J. Abrams and Carlton Cuse and Damon Lindelof have a way that they're going to solve this after 6 seasons.
As you know, it is almost impossible to try to explain Lost to people who have not been following the show for these many years. But ABC tried and put together an 8-minute video summing up the first 5 seasons. It's at our website, hereandnow.org. But just give us a brief primer, Nancy. Where are we now?
Where we are now, a couple of very key characters, Jack Shepard, who is the very handsome male lead of the series, and John Locke, and whether or not they are going to battle the forces good versus evil, and who will take over the island, if anyone's even going to take over the island, and is it an island?
Who knows? Well, let's dive into some of the theories, Nancy, because we actually have quite a few Lost fans among us here at the station.
Good.
Here's Brent Bachman, who works in the newsroom, as I said, at our home station, WBUR.
I think Jack Shepard is always right. So whatever he thinks, I think is going to work out. But I don't really know what he thinks.
Do you know what he thinks, Nancy?
Oh, Jack Shepard. I think that we are supposed to want to follow Jack Shepard to the end of the series. But it would be just like Lost to twist this on us at the very last minute. And I have my own theory that Hurley is going to be, and I could be totally wrong, okay? But I have a feeling that Hurley, who seems to have a lot of the same powers that Jacob does, a very intuitive sense about people. He can see dead people, and he seems to have some sort of angelic quality.
Here's another theory. Let's throw this one out. Here's Sarah Knight. She heard this intriguing rumor about 2 of the main characters, Jin and Sun, who died in this week's episode, and it touches on the theme of the candidate, the person who will go on to apparently protect the island in the future.
I read an article online that quoted Daniel Day Kim. He plays Jin, saying that Sun and Jin's daughter is going to play a role in the final episodes. And I'm wondering if that daughter is the Quan that's a candidate. They didn't know if it was Sun or Jin, but maybe it's the daughter.
I haven't even considered that.
The daughter who's like 3 years old? I mean, what is she talking about? What do you think about that?
So Sun and Jin are this married couple, and they were on the list. And the list is of people who will have some sort of crucial impact on the fate of the island. And their last name is Quan. On the list, written in this cave, all these names, and it just said Quan, but it didn't say whether it was going to be Sun or Jin, so we thought both of them might be candidates, but it could be the daughter who will somehow have to return to the island. I hadn't heard that theory. But I would be very surprised if a cast member actually revealed something that was true. The cool thing about Lost is that they don't just work within the series. They have all of these other things, from bogus websites to kind of leaking fake information. I wouldn't be surprised if that was kind of a red herring they threw out there to get us talking about that as a possibility. But it's a very intriguing prospect.
You know, I hear you speak, and I'm curious, with all the twists and the turns and the puzzles and the bizarre plots, almost unexplainable.
Right.
Why are the fans of this show so obsessed with it? I mean, does it have to do with the mystery of it, that nobody ever really knows what's going on?
First, that it's amazing that this show can exist on network television. The fact that a network is allowing a show to take so many sort of creative chances. And I think also, as viewers of network television, we're sort of committed to a show that we like. We get involved, invested in the characters, and we will pretty much follow the characters wherever they go. And I think that's key on Lost. And I think something that people forget is that Lost is a character-driven show. I mean, the sci-fi stuff is great. The brain pretzels are really great. But ultimately, who we care about are the characters and the fate of those characters, like any good drama. So I think that's really key in when you're wondering why people are staying with this show that is impossible to describe to someone who hasn't seen it without sounding like a crazy maniac. We stick with it because we care about the fate of those characters.
Well, let's listen to another theory, Nancy. Here's Here and Now producer Karen Pellin. She has an unusual theory about the smoke monster, also known as the Man in Black.
He's trying to kill off all these people, but he can't tell them that he's doing it for their own good because they won't buy it. So he has to cause them to shoot each other and submarines to blow up and everything. And that's how he will, this Man in Black, eliminate this reality, the island reality, and elevate the parallel reality to the real reality, if you will.
Okay, so, you know, she's talking about these two parallel plot lines that are going right now on the show. One is the island narrative, which is the people have returned to the island and they're there, and the fate of what happens to them is in the hands of this creature who's the smoke monster, who's the Man in Black. And then there's the parallel, which is the side time travel. So there's a parallel universe where their lives are what would their lives would be had the plane not crashed. Now, my concern is if they make the parallel reality, which is if the plane hadn't crashed, the actual reality, then we've got sort of what is the worst science fiction cliche, which is the this is all a dream kind of thing.
If you could see Karen Pellin the way I can see her right now, objecting to what you're saying, Nancy.
Oh, I would love to know her counterpoint, what she thinks is really going to happen.
She's going to call
please,
you.
Okay. Please call me. Please. I have to talk. I could be totally wrong.
So if you could slip through a wormhole and talk to J.J. Abrams before he started writing this show, what would you tell him?
Gosh, I wouldn't know how to begin to think about what to tell J.J. Abrams, except that watch out. If this series doesn't end the way that people hope it will end, there will be a fatwa issued against him, and I worry about the safety of his writers because people are so into this show. They're going to be obsessed with what happens and talking about it for years.
It is a lot of pressure, isn't it? I mean, the great expectation for a finale like this one.
And if they've set something up, I mean, I think the writers have admitted that there was a time there they didn't know what the heck was going on themselves. So I sometimes wonder if they're not just kind of making this up week by week, but I sure hope not.
Nancy Miller of Wired Magazine, thank you.
Thanks. Dominated.